Hey, it's time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, the longest running radio show in the history of the Western civilization.
Is that true? Do you have evidence to back up that claim?
No. No.
Just your assertion?
Well, who was that guy who had a show for a long time? It's an old codger. Terry Wogan. Terry Wogan, yeah. Well, after 5 years, I don't think anyone who actually listened to the show was conscious, were they?
Yes, and maybe if you make this assertion, they'll just think that we've been on as long as Terry Wogan was.
Well, our show, we get people who actually listen to the show. Terry Wogan, you know, people, they have in the background while they're, you know, feeding their cat or, you know, giving themselves a breast examination, but they don't actually listen to the show, do they? Because it's nothing, that's just like mood music, you know, on the way to the boneyard.
Yes, you've often pointed out that when we're in the UK, a lot of the radio is mood music for dogs.
Oh, well, the BBC Four, it's the most listened to radio station in the world by cats.
So, Max, here's a big headline on the Telegraph today, and I want to ask your opinion about it.
Okay, great.
Pain for motorists as filling car with petrol touches 100 pounds. The cost of... I guess that made you yawn. The cost of filling a large family car with petrol rose to almost 100 pounds yesterday as forecourt prices reached record heights.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about this, about the you know, there's two phases to the crisis. There's the crisis that we started talking about in 2005, the real estate collapse crisis. This was when banks like Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock were offering 125% mortgages against homes, said that was going to lead toward bankruptcy and collapse, which it did. A lot of people couldn't believe it because they said house prices can only go up. That's why it's called a housing ladder and not a housing slide or chute. And then the banks and the government got together, and to save the creditors, the banks who made the loans, they bailed out the banks, they nationalized the banks. They expanded the balance sheet of the Bank of England by, £1 trillion, £2 trillion, depending on how you account for it with off-balance sheet items. Same thing happened in the U.S. and in Europe. So now phase two of the crisis will be this inflation. Now, in phase one of the crisis, it caused a lot of people to go negative equity on their home, and their net worths were decimated in many ways, and they suffered a tremendous amount of loss. And something like the riots in London a few months ago, where the hoodies were out ransacking the neighborhood and stealing, causing mischief. That was a direct result of the crisis, the housing crisis. That was kind of the big, interesting conclusion of phase one of the crisis. You know, I don't know what you'd call it, the climax. Okay, now we're into phase two, and now phase two is inflation. Phase two is that all this money, there's trillions of pounds and dollars and euros and yen, are going to start to do things like make the price of gas all-time high, never been higher, and it's going to continue to go higher. And this is the next part of the crisis. You're going to start to hear people... See, before it was a deflation crisis, that the house prices collapsed below negative equity, and it was massive deflation. Even though some people like to say, oh, this is inflation. No, it was deflation. They were printing lots of money, and people saying, oh, this is going to lead to inflation. That's right, but it didn't happen until now. Now we finally have the inflation. And so the central bank, their only weapon to fight inflation would be to raise interest rates. But then, well, during the bailout, they took on another £1 trillion in debt. So if they raise interest rates, debt service for the government would guarantee another economic collapse. So this puts everybody into this very, very narrow policy box. You have two choices at this point. A, raise rates and collapse the economy and start all over again, which is politically untenable. Or B, go into a hyperinflationary environment, print money very, very aggressively. And I believe that they'll go down path B. The policymakers will, of course, believe that they can control the hyperinflation. And this is what policymakers throughout history have believed. This is why no fiat money ever in the history of the world has ever survived. Every single fiat currency that's ever been created has eventually gone to zero. So now today in the global fiat currency driven world, where since 1971 we've only had fiat currencies trading against each other, none are anchored to anything like gold. They're all going to zero. The yen, the pound, the dollar, the euro, they're all going to virtual zero against gold. Now, what does virtual zero mean? It means that in the case of the U.S. dollar, they'll replace it with a new currency, etc., and a new fiat currency as a way to, as they've done during other hyperinflationary crises, they replace one with another. And it's really interesting because that price, 100 pounds to fill up your tank, will soon be 200 pounds within 6 months.
You know, I was watching this long interview with Bob Janjua, one of the top guys at Nomura Bank here in London, and he was being interviewed on Bloomberg, and he was talking about quantitative easing, and, you know, there are allegedly a whole bunch of new rounds of it coming, and he was saying, similar to what you're saying here, is that what's the point of it? Because in order for it to succeed, you need money velocity. And if you get that money velocity, then the crisis becomes worse because mm-hmm. you're going to get hyperinflation.
Right.
So he maintains that, in fact, gold will go to 1-to-1 to the Dow, that we're in a basically, there's no way out other than that. Gold will correct everything.
Yeah, he's right. His comments are good in that you can print all this money, but if you don't get the velocity, it doesn't mean anything. So during the last 3 years, during the housing crisis, they printed up lots of money, but house prices kept going down. So it didn't work. Now, all these corporations, for example, are flush with cash. They've never had more cash. Banks have never had more cash. And so now they're in a very sticky position because the ability to take the cash out of the system is one which will encourage exactly what we've seen right now, the inflation.
But also, as this article about the cost of filling the tank suggests, is, you know, this is also a policy that successive governments during this crisis have had, is that at all costs, you must maintain the high housing prices, because this is the feel-good factor for a very important voting sector of the population, the middle class and the upper middle class. And yet you see how everybody else is made to pay for this, because it's not just people who own cars, because remember, all our food and everything is delivered in a lorry, which has to fill up as well. So these costs are trickling down to everybody. Now they say that the price of gas is now, petrol is now at 140.2p per liter. It's the equivalent of £6.37 a gallon, which for Americans out there is $10.10 a gallon. Filling a large family car with a 70-liter tank, such as the Ford Mondeo, with unleaded petrol now costs £98, a rise of £6 since just the start of the year. So this is the trickle. You know, if you take £6 from every single person in the nation, or half of them, instead of, you know, letting the housing market prices adjust to reality, this is the slow sort of Japanese trickle way of death.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. You know, during the crisis, of course, the policymakers said this was a crisis that nobody saw coming. And it was a freak accident, you know, that just the markets collapsed. They seized up and we had to bail out all the bankers. People bought that argument because a deflationary collapse is quite frightening, and they allow the policymakers to engage in propaganda and bogus rhetoric by saying that this was not directly the result of irresponsibility by the banking sector. But on an inflationary climb, as we're now going to be experiencing, it's hard for people to say that they don't know what's causing it or they don't know where it came from. They can't use that excuse anymore. So, and as you point out, initially, when prices go up, because this will pull up, for example, the stock prices will go up during this period, which will make people feel like things are good. But at the same time, it's only as a result of the currency debasement, in this case, the British pound. So at some point, when the currency debasement really starts to frighten people, then you get into that hyperinflationary blow-off phase. And also, I read an interesting comment about the difference between the 1970s, where you had an inflationary period. It developed over a number of years, and you still had wages at that time were also going up, which you don't have now, of course, because there's no ability for those who earn a wage. There's no lobbying representation for them, so they haven't earned a wage increase commensurate with inflation for 30 years, so that's not part of the mix. But the difference between now and 40 years ago, 35 years ago, is probably that this hyperinflationary dislocation or currency devaluation that will be required against gold will happen quite suddenly. So you see kind of foreboding of this going on with these flash crashes. And there was another one on Friday. The Apple computer, based on one trade of 100 shares, traded down 9%. So here's a company worth $550 billion. So, you know, $55 billion was wiped off the value in one trade, one fraction of a second. Then they said, wait, oh, that's an error. And they restored the price. But this is yet another one of these flash crashes. So what we're talking about here would be a global flash crash, a tsunami, a financial tsunami, a financial earthquake, where gold gaps up. Gold gaps up from $1,600 an ounce to $3,000 an ounce. But by then, if you don't own your gold, it's too late. That's why it's very, very important to position yourself ahead of this gap opening. And of course, last week and the week before, you had people like Ben Bernanke out there, who is a Federal Reserve Chairman in Washington, D.C., bad-mouthing gold all day long. At the exact same time, every central bank in the world has reverse position, and for the first time in 30 years, they've been buying gold. So, you know, once you realize, you know, the architecture of the propaganda, you begin to take actions accordingly. And, of course, gold has gone up every year for 12 years in a row, so it's not like the people who have been bad-mouthing gold have been right at any point during the last 12 years. So I wouldn't expect them to be right now.
Now, another thing that happened this week in the UK was the budget. And now George Osborne has introduced the granny tax, is what they're saying, what they're calling it. Now, his argument for this, by the way, I just saw yesterday, was that it is... Basically, he was saying it is wealth redistribution, but away from the old to the young, and that it's been the other way around for the last few decades. Of course, however, with our crony capitalist bought and paid for, you know, parliaments and congresses around the world, I just like what we reported on in Ireland for today's episode of Kaiser Report, is that the people just don't believe when you are taxing them that it's actually going to go to services or to what you say. They really believe it's all going to the bankers. So In Ireland, in the case of Ireland, 85% of the population has not paid this new property tax that they're supposed to pay by March 31st. 85% have not paid it. And when they talk to the normal citizen who's not paying it, who's refusing to pay it, they say it's because they think it's just going to the bankers instead. So is this the case that no matter what you say you're doing this for, as George Osborne says, he has a lofty goal for this. Is he really ever going to redistribute in a way he says is for good purposes?
Well, he's lying because he says that he's reversing the trend of the past couple of decades. That's a bald-faced lie. That's a patent lie. That's an unbelievably shameless lie. Because what we've seen over the past 10 years during what's called quantitative easing, by definition, is the central bank forcing long-term rates down to zero. Who suffers? The pensioners. The pensioners already have been underwriting and subsidizing the bank bailout. They have already given a pound of flesh. No banker bonuses were taken away. No banks were penalized in any way. No, the savers were penalized. The pensioners were penalized. They're the ones. They're the heroes. So what does George Osborne do in thanking them? He hits them up with a tax that's going to have them pay even more of these banker bonuses. This is and of course he cloaks it under the guise of helping the next generation, while simultaneously has he done anything about the university top-up fees, which we've said since they were originally introduced would end up going absolutely the way that they've gone. Constantly increase the fees, constantly put this generation into more debt. Did he do anything for debt relief for this? No, I mean, his rhetoric is atrocious. But the mainstream press, like the Economist and the Financial Times, gives him a buy. Nobody really slaps him in the face like he should be slapped. I mean, maybe there's someone, the Guardian, possibly, but the left wing press on the financial front is always very, very weak because they're afraid to speak specifically about finances because they might alienate their constituents of financial illiterates.
So Max, here's another topic I want to discuss, and you've also often talked about that banks should just be treated and regulated as utilities, and there are certain sectors of the economy that should always be like that. The notion of privatizing everything and that somehow efficiency and highly paid CEOs are somehow going to make a plain old utility work better is this false ideology that gets proven over and over to be open to fraud. So a leak shows A4E managers knew of potential fraud in 2009. Managers at A4E, the welfare-to-work firm at the center of a fraud inquiry into some of its employees, were made aware of potential criminal or irregular activity at the company's offices across Britain as long as 2009. So this is a firm that was handed basically anybody who's on benefits, and they're supposed to look for jobs and as part of their weekly benefits, and they have to meet with this. Basically, they were handed a previously government function, this company. And what they found was systemic fraud across all of the centers across the UK. And what they were doing is it wasn't just one bad apple. The whole entire company was a bad apple. They were basically filling out forms, sending it into the government, saying they placed somebody in a job that they had never placed in a job. Or they robo-signed, basically. It was just like the robo-signing fraud in the United States. They signed, they would pretend to sign from John Lewis that they had permanently placed somebody at a job at John Lewis when, in fact, it was only 2 weeks. Or they would either forge the signature or they would get the person at John Lewis to sign it, though the person signing it didn't understand what they were signing. So they tricked them into signing something that was something else. And then this company was making tens of millions of pounds off of these fraudulent systemic fraud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's typical, isn't it? I mean, so getting back to just to touch on the Irish situation again, the end of the month, this tax is due, and 85% of the people have not paid the tax. And let's hope that no one else pays this tax, because they're right, and they think that the money is going directly to bankers, like right into Anglo-Irish and Sean Fitzpatrick and those people. They're absolutely right. So they should, of course, not pay that tax. And we talk about it today on our Kaiser Report show, which people can watch on YouTube. But this scandal that you're mentioning here, this is the result of overly cheap money, and you know, and the fact that it just breeds financial scandal and pyramid schemes and larceny, and it just becomes a hotbed of financial criminality, and which leads to more money printing instead of policy enforcement. Instead of enforcing regulations, they just print money because it's the easier, softer way to do it. And now you've got the result of inflation for stuff like gasoline, which is now on the verge of becoming out of control. Just like the deflation when the house prices started to roll over a few years ago, the first 6 months or so, people didn't give it much concern. They said, well, you know, it's going through a six-month pause, and then up the property ladder will go. Well, no, it turned out to be, in 2008, a systemic global catastrophe. Now we're getting the flip side, another systemic global catastrophe, but driven by inflation.
Yeah, well, it's pretty amazing. And it also just shows you that once a system becomes rotten, it metastasizes. It's just everywhere, and it's hard to stop it. It's really hard to just carve out that one little bad apple there who was in the Slough office and now must get fired, and it's all okay. We threw out the bad apple, but it's at the heart of our system is just totally rotten. A lot of it has to do with the top and the fact that these guys are immune from any prosecution. And of course, Max, the big news last night was John Corzine.
Oh yeah, MF Global. So when he testified before Congress originally, his testimony was saying that the $200 million that left an account, a segregated customer account, and ended up at J.P. Morgan, he didn't know how that happened. That was his original testimony. And they went ahead and they passed a law, the Corzine Law, or they're trying to pass a new law called the Corzine Law, which would require CEOs to sign off on any time customer money from segregated accounts was transferred in a way that didn't comply with any known statutes or laws. Well, lo and behold, now this memo comes out yesterday and said that John Corzine personally authorized the transfer of $200 million to J.P. Morgan from a customer accounts, breaking the law. So a few things here. Number one, he perjured himself. So he'll have to, that'll be something that he has to explain in front of the congressional hearing, I guess, again, perhaps. Number two, he broke the Corzine Law even before it was enacted. So somehow he went backwards in time and broke the law before it had been written. I mean, this is part of this new world of faster-than-light particles. You know, people, criminals like Corzine can go backwards in time and commit crimes, you know, to bilk people and steal money from people. So you've got that element to it. So now the other piece then is, okay, here we have some evidence that the guy perjured himself. Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan, as I've made the contention since December, basically threatened Corzine and said, if you don't move $200 million right now, you know, this is going to end very, very badly for you. So that can of worms is opened. But the question, of course, is, will this piece of evidence, like every other piece of evidence, simply get swept under the carpet and ignored in a way that, you know, I like to compare it to what's going on in Florida right now. You know, a guy with a gun who deputized himself as a neighborhood watch guy was stalking a kid and shot him dead in the street in cold blood murder. And there hasn't been any arrest. There's been no investigation. They're just now thinking about maybe this might be wrong. But this is very similar to the Corzine case. Corzine just in cold blood, him and Diamond, colluded completely outside the law to steal $200 million from customer accounts. And similar to the Florida case, it's a shocking, you know, murder. In this case, a capital crime. But people just have a glazed look in their eyes. They don't seem to have any problem with this.
Yeah, well, a few things. Okay, so in that case of Trayvon Martin, the young black kid, 17 years old, who was shot dead by a 28-year-old guy who was almost 100 pounds heavier than him and who was a man, when the police arrived at the scene just moments after, they tested the dead kid for drugs or alcohol in his system. They never tested the guy, the half white, half Latino guy who shot him dead. And they never took him in for questioning. They just let him go there at the scene, the guy who shot this kid dead. They assumed his story must be true because here was a teenage black kid and he must be the party at fault. Now, with the Corzine story, yeah, to you and I and the rest of, to you, me, and the rest of the world, he perjured himself. But I've been looking at the testimony that he actually spoke in front of Congress under oath. He wasn't allowed to, you know, during a lot of these investigations into the collapse of the financial market, a lot of those CEOs like Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein didn't testify under oath. They didn't have to. They only showed up on the condition that they didn't have to testify under oath. Now, Corzine had to. And if you read the way he spoke, he said that he was stunned in disbelief when he heard about the missing money. When he was asked if he had ordered the commingling of client funds, he said, "I had no intention to ever authorize the transfer of segregated monies." He said, "If that's what happened, if somebody might have misunderstood me and transferred from segregated fund, but it was not my intention that they do so."
Right. And at the time, much was made of his use of this word intention, because the law reads that if you have intention, then it's a quite a serious crime breaking spree. So by saying, repeating over and over again that it was not his intention, he gave himself this pathway of exoneration. Okay, so that was his testimony. Now this memo comes out that appears as though he had the intention. It contradicts his claims. He intended, in that he gave a direct order to move this money. I mean, parsing the words and using high-priced lawyers to drill down into what the definition of is, to use Bill Clinton's famous wiggle, you know, is this going to lead somewhere? Well, down in Florida, again, to use this analogy, there are thousands of people out in the street protesting and demanding some kind of justice. So, will there be thousands of people in the street demanding justice for Corzine? Maybe.
Well, of course, this Corzine crime, this specific $200 million from segregated accounts that he ordered transferred to J.P. Morgan, that came directly to cover an overdraft in the London account of J.P. Morgan Chase, because you know no crime, no financial crime is complete without London in the role. London is the capo de capo in this. You have to pay a certain percentage, just like Al Capone. Like if you committed a crime as a mafia dude at some time back in the 20s, you had to pay Al Capone. You showed up with a wad of cash to pay him.
Well, the cover of the Economist magazine on Friday says it all. It's a photo, a mashup of David Cameron as a concierge at a fancy hotel. George Osborne is the doorman, and Vince Cable is carrying the bags. And you know, their comments on the budget, Osborne's budget, is that it encourages global companies to do business in London. Well, what do these global companies in business do primarily? they engage in rehypothecation scams, as was the case with MF Global, which is outright criminality, laundering money, all the criminal acts of finance we've been talking about go through London, primarily because the regulations are the lightest in the world. And this new budget by Osborne makes it so that more corporations are incentivized to commit more financial fraud in the city of London.
Well, I don't think the regulations are actually the lightest in the world. The politicians are corrupt enough and the regulators are corrupt enough here, just like they were in Chicago, in which they allowed Al Capone to thrive in Chicago. Here, the fact is there is prohibition in credit and movement of money. Any normal person knows how hard it is to transfer money. Any normal person knows that. But in that situation of prohibition, where for certain people it's very expensive and difficult, in that system in which you also have corruption and crime that goes unpunished and untouchables as the Corzines, well, certainly in this case, it's actually not John Corzine, it's J.P. Morgan, it's Jamie Dimon. But again, going back to this story, it's going to be his word against, he's already said in testimony, he said, if somebody took this as the meaning of my instruction, they misunderstood me because it was not my intention whenever I gave an order that this should happen, that segregated customer funds should be used. Because the memo released Friday details an email by Edith O'Brien, an assistant treasurer at MF Global, saying the transfer last October 28th per JC's direct instructions would cover an overdraft in the London account of JP Morgan Chase. So it's only her word in an email at the time where she's saying it was per his instructions. Now, in testimony to Congress, he said, if that's what somebody took my meaning to be, my instruction to be, they were wrong. They misunderstood me.
Yeah, it's like plausible deniability, yeah, which is what Oliver North used to justify the Iran-Contra scandal, yeah, under Reagan. I mean, the fact is that the justice system is never going to be perfect, and if you allow people to claim plausible deniability, then there is no such thing as justice. And as far as London and the regulatory environment, I mean, my understanding is that if the rehypothecation is done in New York, you're limited to 140% of the value of the securities that you're hypothecating. Yeah. In London, there is no such 140% limit. It is infinite rehypothecation. You can use the same securities as collateral to borrow more money in an endless loop that there's no limit whatsoever. I can use the same $1 million worth of gilts and borrow $10 million against it today, and then I can borrow $10 million against it tomorrow, and $10 million again ad infinitum. There's no limit. The only market supposedly is the action in the market, which is going to curb my behavior. But if the central bank is engaged in quantitative easing and keeping interest rates at zero, then I have infinite free money, and that's what Osborne and Cameron are advertising for corporations around the world, is to come to London, do all your money laundering here and your rehypothecation in the city of London. We'll keep interest rates near zero by penalizing grannies, by getting people on fixed incomes to subsidize this criminality.
Well, this is the country, this is the world we all live in, y'all. You know, I'm looking at another big story over on Zero Hedge from the days of 2008, the day the world almost collapsed. Mystery of the day. Who wrote this email to the Fed just before Lehman's collapse? So there's a redacted email from some files, I guess, that were released from the Fed, from Freedom of Information request, perhaps, somebody wrote to Randall Krosner at the Fed. The subject line is urgent, Lehman. So this is before Lehman collapsed. And they said, let's assume government not interested in bailout. You should strongly consider stepping in as counterparty on all repo trades where Lehman has posted collateral, not the reverse, in my opinion. There will be haircuts. There will be higher haircuts, if not a refusal to lend to dealers on a go-forward basis. There will be funds breaking the buck. There will be a wave of selling unlike any we have seen before. If Fed liquidates repo collateral in an orderly manner, Fed will have an unsecured claim vis-a-vis estate, other Lehman creditors. However, you need to make one huge demand. Anyone who takes Fed as counterparty must agree to clear all future repos through a central clearinghouse mechanism where a competitive market exists, i.e. two or more clearinghouses or a nonprofit entity should, such as the DTCC, for the next 5 years. We must end the insanity of the too big to fail banks. And he also says if the repo market shuts down, it's game over. And I'm not trying to be dramatic.
Yeah. And?
So they're all wondering why, like, this, whoever this person was very right about the too big to fail, also about the funds breaking the buck and what would happen. But the Fed did the opposite. They didn't do what this guy had suggested, and they hadn't. It's just interesting to me anyway, as a curious, as somebody who was participating in reporting on the news at the time, that you know, all this sort of information from those days, those emails, this was went to one of the heads of the Federal Reserve Bank. So this is the sort of information he was receiving at the time. But obviously they chose not to act on it.
Well, it's not a secret. The flip side is the inflation. That's the worry now, because of all of that that's happened has resulted in a problem of too much cash sloshing around the system. And so that 100-pound, you know, cost of filling up your car, that's going to double now. I mean, this is the next thing. So instead of your house price crashing, the cost of filling up your car will double. And so it's the same end result. I mean, you're a lot poorer for it. The people who are responsible are going to make a lot more money again. They will say that, it's just going to be harder to claim that they can't have any control over it. Because I think for example, gas price in the United States is at all-time high in dollar terms. And people are blaming Barack Obama. And they say, the president of the United States, you know, the gas is going higher. You need to do something. So they're willing to associate a name and a person with the condition of the higher gas price. Whereas when the house price was collapsing, you couldn't point to anyone because they said it was a systemic failure. And the bankers were able to hide in the tall grass of financial ambiguities and lack of financial reporting in the mainstream media to step aside and just let the situation collapse and pick up their bonus. But inflation is different because people are more willing to associate the condition with a person, with an event, with a timeline. And so this is what they're pointing to Obama and saying, this is inflation and you need to do something. Now, going back to the last time you had this kind of inflation in the 70s, you know, Paul Volcker in the United States came along and he took interest rates up to 20% interest rates, as we've been saying, are close to 1%. He went, imagine this, up to 20%. And this is the remedy. As I wrote in the Huffington Post 6 years ago, when I was invited to write a column or a blog on Huffington Post, my first blog suggested that, look, the only higher margin rates are going to snuff out this corruption, as is the case when you have a system run as a monetary system in the way that it's run. So this is going to bring this the inflation is going to start to really hurt. Then the only solution is to raise interest rates, which is then going to be like an Iceland situation, which will collapse the economy completely. And there's going to have to be a massive reconstruction, like a Bretton Woods era. Post-World War II re-architecture of the global economy against gold. Okay, now the timeline is pretty much as we've been saying all along. I mean, we said 6 or 7 years ago that this is kind of the what's going to happen, and it's happened along that script pretty nicely. It takes 6, 7, 8 years to play out. It's tough to to kind of babysit this narrative for 8 years in a world that thrives on instant gratification and waiting 3 hours in line to be the first, one of the first people to touch an iPad screen. You know, I mean, this is, so when you say, well, you're going to have to wait 8 years for this to play out, you know, people don't even know what 8 years means. It's a concept that they have no idea what this means. But here we are 8 years into this double-edged financial collapse. Now it's the inflation part. It'll take 6 months to a year to play out, and it's really the most devastating. This is going to be the most destructive part because the currency itself now will be destroyed.
Well, speaking of destroyed, Max, can you tell us what the significance of this story? BAT's IPO reversal may cost Morgan Stanley and banks $7.1 million. So BAT's Global Markets, BAT's initial public offering, has been pulled. What does this mean?
Well, BAT's was a high-frequency trader that decided to raise some money by going public. On the day that it was going public, their system crashed Apple Computer.
Oh, it was their system that crashed it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So the IPO was pulled. So the cost of doing an IPO is not trivial. So the underwriters are going to lose $7 million or whatever as part of the pulling of the IPO. It's very rare for an IPO to be pulled on the day that it's supposed to go public. It's very, very rare. But this is exactly what happened because high-frequency trading – of course, now this given a lot of people have come out and said high frequency trading is incredibly destabilizing to the markets, and of course it is. And so this is another interesting aspect to Friday's action.
So they're saying that BATS joins a handful of other companies that have retracted IPOs post pricing. So it had already been priced. Wilt Chamberlain's Restaurant Incorporated, owned by the former basketball star, withdrew a $9.8 million IPO in 1993 after the shares fell by 30% from the offering price. Now, BATS is owned by Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, Getco, and Lehman Brothers. The estate of Lehman Brothers are among the owners of BATS. Almost half of the shares offered were to come from the estate of Lehman Brothers, with another $1.1 million from Getco, according to the prospectus. So data received by Bloomberg around 11 a.m., this is about the Apple collapse in price, the flash crash. Data received by Bloomberg around 11 a.m. yesterday in New York showed BATS stock, the first ever listed on its Lenexa, Kansas-based market, quoted at pennies after being priced at $16 on March 22nd, close to the same time a transaction on Apple shares was executed on BATS that was so far from the market price that it led to a halt. So they were being priced at pennies anyway.
Yeah, because the high frequency trading is a way to game the system faster. It's a high frequency scam. High frequency. I mean, it's like having Bernie Madoff operating at close to the speed of light. So instead of Bernie Madoff ripping billions over 30 years, he can rip billions out of the system over 5 minutes. It adds nothing. It's just a rent-seeking piece of technology that sucks cash out of the system, siphons money out of the system for no reason, doesn't do anything. On the day that it was going to go public for the company, it was malfunctioning horridly. But the entire concept is a non-starter malfunctioning concept. There's no need for this. Now, people are going to use this to be more critical of high-frequency trading. So there's a lot of that in the press. So there'll be a lot of debate about why it's good, why it's bad. The people who say it's good will say it's adding liquidity and they're making a market. We've already discussed why those arguments don't hold any water. The people who are bad will be positioned as terrorists and taken out back and shot.
So, you know, just to go, there's some interesting details here on the Bloomberg story for people who might not know, like Max, how the whole process is. But IPOs, initial public offerings, usually close 3 business days after the first trading day, after which sales of the stock are final. Closing dates are sometimes as much as 5 or 10 days after the pricing. BAT's IPO was scheduled to close on March 28th, so next Tuesday, I think, the company said in a statement yesterday. Bats had sold 6.3 million shares on behalf of existing stockholders, according to a statement. The exchange had initially offered the stock for $16 to $18, so I guess it went down to pennies.
Right, they priced the deal. It takes us a three-day settlement date. That's how long it takes to settle a trade. So when you buy a stock, you have 3 days to pay for it, basically. And so based on the three-day settlement date, you price the deal. People are participating in this deal by buying shares. There's what's called the green shoe, which is an allotment of shares that is controlled by the underwriters to account for any people who are last-minute cancellations or any problems. They float the stock on the exchange, and then the money comes in from the customers closing out 3 days later, and it's now a publicly traded company. So they priced the deal, and then after they priced the deal, they had this catastrophe happen, so they pulled the deal. As I said, it's very rare. The Will Chamberlain deal, you know, by comparison, I mean, that's a very small deal. It was obviously cooked up by probably an underwriter, not even a bulge bracket firm, as it's called. One of the bigger firms was probably underwritten by a chop shop somewhere, like, you know, a firm you've never heard of. And it was, you know, that would happen every once in a while. But for to have a company that's co-owned by all these major banks, who presumably know something about banking, to then have to be pulled on the day that it's going public, shows that the banking system is run by people who are incredibly reckless. This is like just an incredibly reckless deal. Don't, you know, imagine these people as truck drivers for a living. They would be smashing, driving trucks off cliffs all day long and saying, we're adding liquidity. We're adding liquidity.
Well, presumably, as you can only go long during an IPO.
No, my truck driver analogy, I mean, if John Corzine were a truck driver, he would drive the truck off a cliff, and his defense would be that I didn't drive the truck off the cliff. You didn't build a road in time. That would be his defense, you see. He'd say, I'm doing my job. I'm driving the truck. You have to do your job by making sure that you build roads fast enough to accommodate my recklessness. That's your job. You see, I'm doing my job. I've got my foot to the pedal, and I'm going at 100 miles an hour, and I'm blindfolded. That's my job. I'm adding liquidity. Unless these wheels are spinning, the entire economy is going to collapse and Al-Qaeda wins. Your job is to build roads as fast as you possibly can to accommodate the fact that I'm doing my job.
Well, using that analogy for this, presumably there are some people out there who bought these shares at $16 to $18 as it was originally priced and then saw it collapse to a few pennies. So they've just been told they drove off the cliff with their money. But now they get to get it back.
Well, the deal's because this deal's canceled. The trade is canceled because it settles in 3 days. So that you officially don't pay for the trade for 3 days. So if there's an event before the 3 days, it's null and void. So the trade never happened. So your money never technically left your account.
So somebody out there is very happy that it was pulled.
Well, nobody paid for their shares because their shares never existed. There's mm-hmm. no shares. There are no shares that ever existed. No one paid for their shares. That was, but this is just like a metaphor for phantom trading, high frequency trading itself. When high frequency trading hits the market, they flood the market with what's called quote stuffing. They'll put in a million orders simultaneously over a 1/1,000,000th of a second to fool the exchange into thinking that there is a orders in the system, let's say orders to sell. As a result, the stock price goes down. But those orders never hit the exchange, and there's no cash that ever changes hands. It's like a denial of service account. It's just a swarm of orders that are never consummated. They're never paid for. It doesn't require any money. It just requires technology. Here, the firm that does the fake phantom trading, that does the high-frequency trading itself, on the day it was supposed to go public, using its own systems, denied its own existence. And it's a hologram that got turned off before anyone saw the illusion that there was a business there.
Well, in our last 5-10 minutes here, I want to say, you know, the Senate has passed this bill in the United States, basically allowing crowdfunding in the United States. You know, you've been able to do it in Europe, but now they're lowering so the Senate version basically is saying that any investor, any normal person can invest in an equity share of a crowdfunded project, whatever that may be, at the maximum is $10,000 or 10% of their income, whatever is the highest or lowest.
All right, so crowdfunding. In the UK, there's a site called Crowdcube that I'm aware of. So projects can raise money up to a certain threshold. I don't know what it is, £1 million or something. And you don't need to file all the SEC documents or FSA documents and hire lawyers and do all this. It takes time, blah, blah, blah. You can just put your projects up on the site. You can get people to put money up for the project. They are equity owners in the project. The other version, of course, would be like Pirate My Film, which is not an equity-based model, where you're essentially donating to the project as raising money. And this is, I think it's a very powerful tool. Like, for example, we're using it to fund investigative journalism, and where there is no money for investigative journalism. So it's a tool in this way. Another science company is using it to raise money to probe for something. I didn't get all the details. It's called petridish.org. So it's about social networking, you know, the economies of the social network used to finance and build projects outside of the current system. So this has great potential. I mean, I would imagine similar to microfinancing, which came along and was fantastic for women in Bangladesh to pull themselves out of poverty. And then within 10 years, the Grameen Bank and the founder, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for this, was thrown to the curb. It was taken over by Wall Street banks, and now it's used as predatory lending. So, yeah, crowdfunding is fantastic. Its current iteration can do a lot of good. I would imagine that within 5 years, it'll be run by Wall Street, and we'll be back to where we were before.
You know, we're interviewing this guy, Michael Bowen, coming up in the next few weeks on Kaiser Report, and he's the head of the P2P Foundation. And he likens it, you know, you're just talking about the predatory lenders coming into any new crowdsourced and crowd-created innovation or a sector. And he compares it to the P2P sector to the early Catholic Church, where it was basically like guys doing a Linux-type system. There were nodes all across Europe where they freely shared information, and they traveled from point to point going to the next, you know, they traveled from Rome to Berlin or Munich, and would give some, transmit knowledge for free to this next node, and that node would go over there and transmit the knowledge for free. And of course, we know that that soon was hijacked by the predatory lenders as well.
Yeah, well, that's right. So Christianity was a religion that was enabled by the existence of those Roman roads, which allowed the apostles to get all over Europe very quickly and spread the word in an open source manner, that, you know, that the love could conquer all, which was the message of Christ. But the whole idea of having a free, open source, love-based religion then was taken over by the Roman Catholic Church, run by the Pope, that turned it into a money-making scheme and destroyed it.
And, you know, we have to end it here, but I wanted to say Irish Debate on Twitter at Irish Debate, they are reporting that apparently there's a national anti-household charge rally at 1 o'clock today in the National Stadium. And
I wish I could be there. I would really want to be there. This is a very important day. Oh, happy Easter. Is it Easter yet? Speaking about failed Christianity.
Oh, I forgot about that. No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because surely the Easter Bunny would have left us some eggs.
Yeah, that Easter Bunny crack whore.
Okay. Well, it's time to say
bye, y'all.